They're out celebrating this historic and very close win. Given that Bolsonaro won't contest the results and the transformation to take place, well, what issues stand tall for Lula da Silva? The economy, foreign policy, Latin American integration? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask those questions from our guests and also look at what to expect from Lula da Silva on the world stage, especially when it comes to the U.S. and as a member of BRICS countries, in terms of its relations, particularly with China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Bruno Biclini, academic and political scientist, joins us from Porto Alegre in Brazil. Also joining us, Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first go to Porto Alegre in Brazil and ask you, Bruno Biclini, is this a good day for Brazil?
Oh, thanks for the invitation. Yes, I would say so. Brazil is very relieved. It's very much more tranquilized because as long as we fix to the manual of political science, an administration like Bolsonaro has a tendency to go in a more proto-fascist way. And also we, 16 million Arab Brazilians community in Brazil, we are very more calm because, example, yesterday, Michelle Bolsonaro, the first lady, went to vote using a T-shirt supporting Israel, supporting Zionist apartheid. So for us, the time for victory today, to getting rid of the fascists and also defeating Zionism in our own country.
I'm sorry, I got to ask you this. Why were they wearing a T-shirt supporting Israel? And because I have to ask this, supporting Israel and the apartheid regime that it is.
Yeah, because they are pro-Zionist. They are pro-apartheid. They have the support of seven big enterprises, very big, huge companies, the so-called new Pentecostal churches, who are supporters for Israel, just like the Bible Belt in the U.S. supports the occupying of Palestine, the occupation in Palestine. So for us, we are 60 million Arab Brazilians in this country. We will have a minister. The vice president is an Arab, Alckmin. The future minister, Haddad.
Interesting.
The Senator Simone Tebet. We are very glad to defeating the Zionists in our country. They supported this fascist president like Bolsonaro, and they supported his policies here. It's
sure.
A good day for us.
Well, that's since our guest has mentioned that, Arnold August, it's quite a contrast to Jair Bolsonaro to Lula da Silva in so many ways. That's just one prime example. I'm not too sure how prime it is in the scale of things. So I want to ask you how Brazilians are now viewing this, because many are saying a reference to the past is being made in terms of a nostalgia of the good days when you had Lula da Silva, who was in power between 2003 and 10, had such an impact in terms of improving the economy, especially for the poor, and things were going well at that point. Do you think he can pull it off again, given the current political and economic landscape that exists today?
Yeah.
No, this is for Arnold August. I'm sorry. I'll get to you with the same question.
Sorry, go ahead,
Arnold August.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm very happy that the other guest mentioned that T-shirt with the Israeli flag. I also saw it, and it goes a long way to indicate to us the differences between the two candidates. And, you know, my basic reaction, of course, that millions of people, especially in the global south, as well as progressive people in the West, we are overjoyed by the defeat of Bolsonaro and the victory of Lula. Of course, it's going to be difficult because aside from the fact that he won by only a small margin, the reports coming, for example, from your Latin American correspondent in Latin America, in Brazil at this time, Camila Escalante, I just saw her Twitter feed, and we see on the streets in Brazil that there are the Bolsonaro followers are organizing blockades of blockading roads, as well as burning tires and screaming, you know, we don't want to be invaded by communism. So we know that for sure that da Silva has
why communism? What is the meaning behind that, Arnold August?
Well, it's very simple. Right from the beginning, Bolsonaro, his main plank was what? Lula is going to bring communism to
in reference
Brazil.
To China, you mean?
No, I think it's mainly a reference, for example, to Venezuela or to Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, and Cuba, of course. Their main, when they talk about communism, it's not China. Because Brazil, even Bolsonaro, he has very close ties with China. I think, in my view, it's mainly playing on any prejudice people may have with regard to the governments in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Cuba. But, you know, so despite all this, he did win. At the same time, you know, Bolsonaro, one has to say that his followers won the some of the most important state governorship. For example, Sao Paulo, the most important state in Brazil, Bolsonaro won that. So, you know, aside from the, you know, what is going on in the streets, these are some of the challenges that Lula has to face.
Okay, so let's talk about those challenges, but briefly, if we can. I need to ask you that, Bruno Bicolini, in terms of the what we read all the way up to this point, which I still think is going to exist based on what we have read about Brazil, and that's this extreme polarization that exists in the country. We thought that the margin of win for Lula would be a lot more, but it wasn't. We're looking almost a straight 50% that are on either side of the aisle. So does that pose a particular challenge for Lula at this point, given that he has won, and how he would approach it, in your opinion?
Well, we must understand that the powers that be in Brazil, at least the half of this, of the major part of it, recognizes on Lula the victory and recognizes that he will be the rule of law. It's something very weird in Brazil. The uprising comes from the ultra-right wing. And also, we must understand that Brazil has been attacked like a fake war to the platforms like Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and they mobilize their base, social bases, between middle-rank entrepreneurs, middle-rank bourgeoisie in Brazil, moving their followers and activating them through a huge, huge financial system. So I would say that Lula won't have many difficulty in the Congress, because the Congress is at least two-thirds of bench keepers and pork barrel who wants budget, but will have some difficulty to change Brazilian society, I would say so. Change the ideological part of the Brazilian society, more connected to the crime of against nature and more connected to the neo-Pentecostal churches, for example.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Looking at that, since you mentioned nature, Lula has promised more social and environmental responsibility, Arnold August. He has talked about how he's going to combat the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, which under, I'm sure you're aware, under Bolsonaro, it was heavily attacked in some respects.
Right.
I'm sorry if I'm using that word attack, but that's how some felt. And at this point, he wants to make Brazil a leader in the global climate talks. How much of that do you think he will pull through and actually honor a pledge that he has made?
Well, I think it may be difficult for him on the international scale, because a lot of important powers, even though they're congratulating or recognizing Lula as having won the election, they are still not really very much in favor of his policy. And I think, in my view, what will facilitate this whole program to change the policy on the Amazon deforestation is the international impact of Lula's victory last night. For example, if we just take North America and South America, the Lima Group, led by Canada and United States, but based also in Argentina, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, those four lost the elections a while ago, and yesterday Brazil lost Bolsonaro. So the Lima group is basically completely non-existent. And this is also, by the way, a repudiation of the Trudeau government.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Of course, Lima group. I mean, first of all, it was basically finished anyways before last night. But I guess we can say, excuse the expression, it was the last nail on the coffin of the Lima group. And as a repudiation, not only of the Trump-Biden policy, but it's also Justin Trudeau's policy with regards to Latin America. And I think that, I think it's very important. I mean, I guess we'll have chance. I think that one of the most important effects would be with regards to BRICS. I think you mentioned in passing. But before doing that, talking about Canada, now, it's very interesting that Canadian government, who attacks Iran with regards to its so-called violation of human rights regarding women, the same Trudeau government supported indirectly the coup against Dilma Rousseff, the first woman president of Brazil. So one has to take this into account as well.
It's taking
up a lot of ideological issues. One cannot look at Canada and its policy with regards to supporting the women in Iran. It is completely arbitrary.
Sure. Since you mentioned the Lima group, altogether, if you want to sum it up, Bruno, in terms of the win by Lula, it kind of consolidates what has been termed as this pink tide in Latin America, which I'm sure you heard of. And at this point, we're looking at how these countries have basically consolidated themselves in terms of governing all the region's major economies, and sort of a shift to the left. Now, what does that particularly say about the West, in particular the U.S. Presence and its financial system, which is dominated by the U.S., and of course its allies and institutions that are Washington-backed, like the World Bank or the IMF, because these countries did not reap the rewards that they were promised. Is this a repudiation of that, or saying no to that, and that's why we're looking at this pink tide, not complete with Brazil's Lula da Silva's win?
Yeah, I think you're right, because with Brazil, it is a possibility to reinforce in the South Bank and having connection to the BRICS bank and getting rid of the dictatorship, the tyranny of the dollar. This is something that Lula would like to improve through his foreign minister, Celso Amorim. The other possibility is to make a reinforcement of the region between trading among us and not trading only for being an export country, a plantation country, or a mining country. I would say that for the regional and to getting rid of the dollar and the projection of power coming from the U.S., Brazil must have a center-left government or even a left government. Lula is a social democrat, but in the international system, he always will be an independent and more closer to the South, Latin America and Africa, for example. So it's a good position for us and a not-so-good position to U.S.
Okay. Well, you talked, actually, about BRICS there, Arnold. August, let's talk about that. Obviously, Brazil is one of the five members, which has India, Russia, China involved in that. And of course, we have Iran and Argentina who have applied for membership.
Right.
What? We have Saudi Arabia that's also interested in jumping on that bandwagon. So that obviously is not good news for the U.S. because it does not want, in particular, any country getting close to Russia, let alone China, which is the U.S.'s end game. So by this win, some are calling it like this headline: Lula's win is game changer for BRICS and Latin America. Is that something that you agree with? And at the same time, a big loss for the U.S. and the West?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, the first thing that came to my mind last night when it was announced formally that Lula won was not so much economic policy or environment, but this is a very important geopolitical change. If we just take BRICS, Russia, India, China, South Africa, these countries, and of course Brazil and Russia, these countries make up 40% of the world's population and 25% of the world GDP. Now, until last night, the only countries in the BRICS which we can say are like solidly against U.S. hegemony and had more or less progressive social programs domestically. All we had was Russia, China, and to a certain extent, South Africa, but not Brazil. Now, this is a game changer. The Brazilian delegation in BRICS is going to be led by the Lula government, which is very much against U.S. hegemony, has very close ties and support, for example, China, Venezuela, Cuba, etc. It's a game changer. And I'm glad that you mentioned that now the recent announcement that Iran and Argentina are going to join. This is very significant. For example, Iran, as you know, it is the second important, if I'm not mistaken, producer of gas, also has a lot of gold. And Argentina is another aspect of the world economy, soya and wheat, which is also very important. So by Lula coming into this, this mix with adding Iran and Argentina, sure, it completely changed, in my view, the political feature of BRICS. Like, in my view, for example, Iran, aside from having a very clear position against U.S. domination and interference, its social policy with regards to health, education, etc., including mm-hmm. women's rights, is very much underestimated.
Well, this is where the question mark comes in, Bruno, and that is the fact that we know, and you could probably tell us better, the fact that Lula wants, for example, a new Latin American currency. Let me come in at this angle, that he wants to create called the SOR, which is not a new idea, but still is something that he wants to do. And he has said publicly that he wants to lessen the dependence on the dollar. And at the same time, he has said we're going to try to recuperate the BRICS. Well, if he wants to do that, at the same time, he has said, some take that as being, well, he wants to distance himself from the U.S. But there are some that say, no, he's going to try to balance that out. But given the current political environment, that's not something that the U.S. you can do with the U.S. the way that the U.S. feels about Russia, and also the way that the U.S. feels about China. And we know that Lula da Silva wants to enhance his relations with China. So which side are you on? Do you think that he's going to be able to balance the two out, or will he go pretty much on the BRICS group of countries, in particular China, and the shift to the east, as many have done around the world?
Well, in the geo-economical policies for abroad, Brazil must go as close as possible to the BRICS and to China and from Middle East. For the international system, he will try to make a balance and taking distance from U.S. And the Europe, subordinated to the U.S. and to the Five Eyes system countries. I would say that the South American currency, it is a possibility if we have a connection or a cooperation between our big oil companies like Petrobras, PDVSA, YPF in Argentina, EPFB in Bolivia. The other possibility is to reinforcing our industrial belts, because Brazil, for example, now only have 80% of his internal revenue, internal production from the industry. We would have 25% of this, of our richness in the 80s. So reinforcing the industry, creating new industries, for example, having a connection with Iran, with Khorasan, INOC, to taking fertilizing technology to Brazil. Fertilizer is very important to Brazil. Those key parts of the geo-economical, we must have as far as possible from U.S. In the international system, we go in the diplomatic way, in a pragmatic way, and be in a balance with U.S. and Europe. I would say so.
Okay. Well, since we just have time for maybe a question here, which will go to you, Arnold August. Looking at the list of priorities that Lula has, ensure that no Brazilian goes hungry, pledging to provide housing for the homeless, jobs, opportunities for the poor, better education, equality for women. I'm going to play bad cop here and say, you know, that's a tall order. Do you really think that he's going to be able to do that? And will it take a lot of time for him to achieve those goals?
Well, it definitely is a tall order because, as I mentioned, amongst other reasons, three of the most important states in terms of population is controlled by the Bolsonaro people. And so we will have to resist the pressure from them. And who knows, there also might be attempts to destabilize the situation in Brazil and to lead it, to make it extremely difficult for Lula to govern. I think it's going to be very difficult. And I think today it may be too early to really predict or say how he can develop those policies. But at the same time, one should not, in my view, get caught up with Lula as a personality, very important. But one has to take into account that his position, his candidacy for president was supported from the hard left, if you like, in Brazil, for example, the Brazilian Communist Party and the Communist Party of Brazil. So he has to also make sure this base is satisfied.
Bruno Bicklin, I have time for one more question to ask you in about 30 seconds. This Latin American integration is what Lula has talked about. How important is that? Will he be able to do that in order for the grouping of Latin American countries to move forward in the world when it comes to different aspects politically, especially in terms of the economies of that integration, as a result of that integration?
If we can establish our own currency, at least for trading, it is a possibility. If we stand together, if we stand alone and getting close to US or to Europe, it will be a lost chance again. Just like, for example, to finish, like IPF in Vaca Muerta, that make an agreement with Chevron and not with Petrobras. We must have the key opportunities and go together. This is a real possibility.
Thank you for that, Bruno Bicklin, academic and political scientist from Porto Alegre in Brazil. Arnold August, a pleasure. Thank you. Author and journalist from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم رب هب لي حكما وألحقني بالصالحين
And he said, My Lord, grant me authority and join me with the righteous.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 83rd verse of this chapter. The verse reads, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ My Lord, bestow wisdom on me and join me with the righteous. We mentioned that Prophet Abraham becomes hopeless of these people, misguided people, the ones who do not accept logic and reasoning, and they don't believe that there exists such a God in the world, so they do not accept what Prophet Abraham says. After finishing his describing the God, he suddenly turns to the Lord and asks him. So he is hopeless of these idolaters. And this is an emphasis of the fact that this is the one whom you should turn to. This is the absolute cause of this universe and the other. رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ So before anything else, Abraham عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَأَلْهِ وَعَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give him a deep and correct cognizance coupled with jurisdiction because no practical program is possible without such foundation. Now, what does he ask next to this demand? He asks Allah to join him with the righteous one. This request that Abraham asks refers to the practical aspects, which idiomatically is called practical knowledge. And this is versus the theoretical knowledge and science that we saw in his former demand. Now, undoubtedly, Prophet Abraham had both the rank of wisdom and he was among the righteous ones. Then, what is the meaning of having these demands? Why does he ask Allah such demands? We'll be back to answer this question after a short break.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Thank you.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the question we asked, dear listeners, was that Prophet Abraham says, Rabbi habli hukman wa alhiqni bis salihin. My Lord, bestow wisdom on me and join me with the righteous. Why is it that Prophet Abraham has these demands? Is he not among the righteous ones? Doesn't he have the rank of wisdom? To answer this question, we must say that neither wisdom nor righteousness has a definite limit. He can be asking Allah that every day he gains more and more levels of knowledge and practice. He is asking Allah to reach higher levels of knowledge and understanding and practical knowledge each day. So he, the Prophet, even as an arch prophet, is not satisfied with these aspects. That is why he is asking the Almighty Allah to give him more. Moreover, he knows that all these merits are from the side of Allah, and every moment they may be seized as a result of a fault. So this could be another emphasis on the fact that we are needy. We are total indigents to Allah in our huduth and our baqa, in our coming into existence and in staying in this world. So besides, he asks Allah its continuation, as every day we ask him in our ritual prayer to guide us into the straight way and demand the continuation and perfection of this way. And at the same time, he teaches us how we should supplicate, how we should ask the Almighty Allah our request. First, we should call him by one of his names, Rabbi. And more interestingly, before he starts asking the Almighty Allah, he mentions his blessings and mercies in the world and in hereafter as well. خَلَقَنِي يَهْدِينِ يَشْفِينِ يَسْقِينِ. He mentions that you are the God who can create me. You are the one who can guide me. You are the one who rescue me, etc. So this is one of the etiquettes of supplication we need to be aware of. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds. President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues, but it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy. President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources, but will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Wednesday's terror attack on Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Iran's city of Shiraz has saddened Iranians as well as many people around the globe. Among them, Afghans who have been bearing the brunt of blind terror attacks for years say the attack opened their old wounds. They say the tragic terror attack touched their hearts and they share the grief of Iranian people.
I express my condolences to all Iranians, particularly those who live in Shiraz, for their losses in the terrorist attack on Shah Cheragh Shrine. I was shocked and saddened that innocent worshippers were killed there. I also express my sympathy with families of victims. Iran has not been only our neighboring country and a friend of Afghanistan, but also a second home for we Afghans.
Indeed, it was a horrific and exhausting attack. We strongly condemn it. We Afghans can feel how terrifying such attacks can be. Of course, the attack on innocent people saddened all informed and civilized people. I hope the perpetrators and organizers of the attack are brought to justice and punished.
Afghan experts and activists stress the need for global unity, especially among Muslims, against terror acts. They believe the enemies of Islam and Muslims try to destabilize the region by sowing discord among its inhabitants.
The important point about the terror attack in Iran is that some countries who claim to be superpowers, and we know them as arrogant, try to protect their hegemony in any way possible. One of their evil deeds has been plotting religious wars. In my opinion, the Shiraz attack was one of such conspiracies. I believe the Iranian people and all Muslims should be vigilant and informed, especially in the current situation.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after a gunman opened fire on pilgrims at the Holy Shrine in Shiraz. Dozens of others were also wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the attack. Many Afghans consider Iran as their second home. Today, people here express sympathy for Iranians, saying they stand with the neighboring nation of Iran. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinians rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to express their solidarity with people in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have stepped up their crackdown, carrying out attacks across the occupied territories and the city of Al-Quds in recent weeks. This while more than 130 Palestinians have been killed by regime forces in the West Bank this year alone, amid an increase in armed resistance. Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
As we stand here, we affirm the unity of the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist enemy. Palestinian resistance factions will always stand by our people in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank in the face of Zionist crimes. We continue our armed resistance until the liberation of Palestine.
While Israeli forces increase their attacks in the occupied West Bank, extremist Jewish settlers have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds under the silent, watchful eye of the international community.
Today we are sending a message of solidarity to our brethren in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. The armed resistance will only increase for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. The Zionist occupation only understands the language of force, and we will continue the fight until martyrdom or freedom.
During the rally, Palestinian resistance groups warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while asserting that armed resistance is the key to freedom.
We are loyal to armed resistance and to the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We are fighting for a just cause, and nothing will break the resistance against the Zionist enemy. The criminal Zionist enemy has committed crimes against the Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, and it will pay for the crimes.
Palestinians say they want the occupied West Bank to be part of a future independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital.
People here vow to utilize all forms of resistance to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Earlier this month, Brussels approved the eighth round of sanctions on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine in an attempt to deprive Moscow of billions of euros in revenues from selling products in the European Union. In a previous round of sanctions, the sixth, Brussels had approved an embargo on Russian seaborne oil that will come into force on December the 5th. This punitive measure will severely affect the Izab refinery, located on Sicily Island in the south of Italy. The refinery, owned by the Russian multinational energy corporation Lukoil, used to buy about 40% of its feedstock from Moscow. Due to the embargo, the plant could shut down in a few weeks, leaving thousands of people jobless.
These workers have been on permanent employment contracts for many years. They are very worried about what lies ahead. A closure of the refinery would reverberate on the region's satellite activities, affecting about 10,000 workers. We have received assurances from the new government that a positive solution will be found.
Although Lukoil was not singled out by EU sanctions, the Izab plant, which accounts for around 20% of Italian refining capacity, has been forced to rely solely on Russian oil since international banks are no longer providing the refinery with credit to buy oil from alternative suppliers.
Per quanto riguarda queste sanzioni sul petrolio,
EU financial sanctions usually contain derogation provisions which allow competent authorities to authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited. These provisions should be immediately applied to the Izab refinery case. This embargo on Russian oil will only have the consequence of further damaging the EU's energy market.
A last shipment of Russian oil is expected to reach the Izab refinery by December the 5th. The Italian government has a bit over a month to find a solution to the issue. There seems to be two ways only to avert the closure of the Izab plant. Either the refinery gets nationalized and the Italian government is reportedly mulling over this option, or it is sold to non-Russian buyers. Some media have reported that US private equity fund Crossbridge is among parties interested in buying the refinery. Actually, there is also a third option that could work for Izab: continue the same way as today. but that would imply a normalization of ties between the EU and Russia, an option that seems non-viable at this stage. Max Civili, Rome.
Rohingya refugees in the suburbs of New Delhi are being threatened by a new onslaught against the community. They claim some men have attacked and beaten women and children living in the refugee camp. One of the women is critically injured and being treated in the hospital. Local residents claim refugee children had blocked a narrow road in the locality, while the members of the Rohingya community maintain they have nowhere to go. Meanwhile, the city police file a complaint and an investigation is underway.
It's the government that sent us here after our camp was burnt down mysteriously. Our children have nowhere else to play or go. This is not the first time we have been beaten up. We don't want any trouble as we are already facing a lot of misery. Our children don't even have the privilege to go to school. What other options do they have?
India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees based on official figures, but reports suggest there are hundreds of thousands living across many parts of the country. Recent expulsion drives from the government have forced many to go into hiding in undisclosed locations, fearing detention, deportation and separation. The Indian government in recent years has taken the issue of these refugees to the parliament, with majority of the members calling them a security threat and therefore demanding their deportation. Rights activists have time and again reminded the administration about their plight, urging them for an immediate halt to any deportation plan. The destitute community is in utter desperation as intimidation, detention, deportation and night raids have become the order of the day. The Indian government calls them a security threat and prone to radicalization. For decades, the minority community faced systematic persecution at home in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. In recent years, the UN has accused Myanmar of genocide after hundreds of thousands fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Rights activists say the ruling BJP is fueling resentment since it won election in 2014. It calls the Rohingya a security threat, while the policy for refugees from other countries remains different. Persecuted Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants wherever they have settled after fleeing carnage in Myanmar. They are now living in makeshift camps as refugees across different parts of South Asia, especially in India, Bangladesh and Malaysia. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect their rights as refugees. They urge the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith.
On the third day of a public mourning in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz, following a terrorist attack on the holy shrine of Shah Cheragh, a huge crowd of people from different walks of life took part in the funeral procession of the victims.
I tell the enemies that we support the establishment and no one can harm it. We will be victorious.
I came to this rally to show that we are united. Iranian people should support each other and stay united so that Iran does not turn into a country like Syria.
At least 15 people were confirmed dead in the terrorist attack on Wednesday, among them women and children.
If you were truly courageous, you would fight in the battlefield, just like what General Soleimani did. But you attack a holy religious place and kill women and children. This is inhumane.
Tens of thousands of mourners from different walks of life took part in the event. Holding pictures of the victims and chanting slogans, the participants condemned terrorism and those behind the vicious act of terror in Shiraz.
It was our duty to take part in this event, and I tell the terrorists who committed this crime that killing us would only make the Iranian nation more conscious.
The mourners also chanted slogans against the supporters of Daesh terrorist group, particularly the United States and Israel. The coffins of the martyrs were then flown to the northeastern city of Mashhad, which houses the mausoleum of 8th Shia Imam Imam Reza, where thousands of mourners bid farewell to the victims.
Shedding the blood of innocent civilians in a religious holy shrine is a heinous crime denounced by people globally. Presence of a huge crowd of people in the funeral of martyrs of Shiraz terror attack shows the Iranian nation's unity in the face of enemies who seek to undermine the country's security. Mahdi Abbasian, Shiraz.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbour, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. But I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
So we are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Zhenimel, Sevastopol, Crimea.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea, as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S. and Japan so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill, North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the ceremonies and saved this holy book, which is the best prescription for liberating human beings from all physical, mental, and intellectual chains, shaking their hands, feet, hearts, and minds, and dragging them toward non-existence, destruction, slavery, and subjugation under the taghutis and oppressors.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that never neglect the Friday and daily congregational prayers, for they are the political manifestation of the prayers. In this part of his speech, obviously he's talking about the congregational prayers, the importance of that, whether it's a daily or the Friday. And the main idea we see that in Islam, that everything is being said to be performed in a group. In the society, you need to socialize with the people. We know that there are many people who are afraid to communicate with others, who may be shy to go in the community to talk to the people. There are some shy people in the society. But Islam is saying that you need to communicate with the people. You need to socialize among the people. Even if you want to pray five-time prayers, it is better to go to the mosque. And it is said that the reward of the prayers that has been done in the mosque in the congregational, it has more reward than when some person does it individually. Or maybe sometimes it is said that if the number of people in that jama'ah, if it increases the specific number, then even the angels cannot count the number of rewards which has been given to each one of them. Therefore, Islam is a religion that takes everyone in a united state, and it wants everyone to help each other. It wants everyone to go with each other, to help each other, and offer prayers together. And yes, there are some individual prayers which is recommended, but that is for the person itself. But the main prayers that we have, the daily prayers, the Friday prayer, they all are in jama'ah, they all are in a group. Ya Rabbana, salli ala. Imam Khomeini is also saying that never neglect the Friday and daily congregational prayers. the negligence of such thing will take us away from the right path, will take us away from the society. When we are not meeting people, we don't know what they need. We don't know what is going on in the society, what society is talking about, what are the important things in the society that we need to take care of, what are the issues, what are the affairs that we need to take care of. Or maybe if I can help someone, if I'm living individually, I might not